thanks, Rachel. So science behind Olympic rowing gold medal, but I don't have one, so you'll just have to take my word for it. But I kind of know how they're going to get it, maybe. Incidentally, these two are the current Olympic champion in the lightweight men's double scull, so I thought it would be a good image to use. Hold on. From the beginning. Okay. So when Rachel asked me to come and talk tonight about sort of science and rowing, I sort of thought, oh, where to start? Okay, I'll go back and I'll go over the key sort of sports science areas that I covered in my undergraduate degree, starting with exercise physiology and then biomechanics and then perhaps some psychology. And then I was watching The One Show last night. I don't know if anyone else watches The One Show. I'm a bit of an addict. And they did a piece all about the GB hockey team. And they basically covered all of the things that I would probably say, a bit about physiology, a bit about biomechanics and psychology and the nutrition and the way the team's looked after. And I thought, the way this is going, with the Olympics coming up, we're all going to be experts in this. You know, the TV coverage, it's, you know, we're all going to know a little bit about how every team trains. So I thought, I'll stick with the same themes, but I think I might go a little bit left field and just give you a few examples of things particular to rowing. Obviously, without revealing any trade secrets, because the sporting community is quite protective, but a little bit of an insight into actually what goes on. So before I start, I'm going to give you a few facts that I just want you to accept are true. Okay. Olympic rowers will be physically training for about 22 hours per week. So us full-timers working amongst you might think that that's not actually a full-time working week, but that's quite a lot of hours to be physically training, and the rest of the week is filled with talk to the nutritionist, work with the physiologist, doctor's appointments, physio, and probably more crucially, a very active part of the day for the athlete is resting and recovery, something that's probably undervalued in many people's opinion. Each athlete will have worked very closely with their strength and conditioning coaches, so you'll have seen this if you saw on The One Show yesterday. Bisham Abbey Gym was shown on TV, and it's been on TV about six times in the last couple of weeks already. Each athlete has a very dedicated weightlifting training programme, which thankfully is written by the very well-trained strength and conditioning coaches and not by rowing coaches. Not work out well. Okay. Rowers will have a high VO2 max. That's a very popular term in exercise physiology. I will come back to it a little bit later, but in brief, it's the maximum amount of oxygen you can consume, and it's the gold standard measure of aerobic capacity. In fact, rowers will have a high VO2 max. On an average, a GB rower will consume somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 calories per day. This is largely made up of carbohydrates, but it's also a careful balance of, you know, the good fats and proteins, which are essential for muscle repair and muscle building. So that I'm probably not going to talk too much more about those things. We're just going to accept them from now on until the discussion, perhaps. So first of all, I just wanted to clear up a few things. What is rowing? Don't know if anybody wants to pitch in a little here. Rowing is actually two sports. It's sweep oar. That's where you have one oar in each hand. So probably the best example, other than the image up there, would be perhaps the Oxford Cambridge boat race that you'll see on TV. And it's sculling. And that's two oars in each hand. Now, I've shamelessly used pictures of myself and data from myself quite a lot in this talk. And that's not really to boost my own ego and presence here. It's really because I own this data. This is me. And so I'm not using anybody else's data when we're talking on the science stuff. So yeah, that's me, that one with the lovely white sunglasses. So sculling is the other category, and that's the only category for lightweight women. So whilst we've got different categories, we've got men and women, we've got lightweights and heavyweights, we all race over the same distance, 2,000 metres straight course. The idea is obviously to go as fast as you can down the course, and most races will be somewhere between about 5 minutes 45 seconds for the men's 8 to 7:40 for the women's single. So it's pretty physically brutal.
Can I just point out that before Andrea and the current crop came on the scene, it was about 8 minutes 15 for a standard lightweight women's single for Britain.
haven't broken 740 though.
10 years ago, nobody even thought about it.
Okay, so we've covered a few of the baseline sort of facts, what is rowing, and a bit of the sort of general things that we need to accept. So, basically, why have sports science support? Well, I think you know it's quite obvious to see with the technological advances in sporting equipment that the speeds are going to improve. If you look at this is the men's eights time for Olympic gold in 1964, it was up around 6:20 markets now. I haven't put the most recent because it hasn't changed too much since 2004, but it's around just over the 5 minute mark. And well, whilst that's obviously there's going to be a massive component of that which will be down to the technological advances in the boats, it's probably no coincidence that this is probably a key period in time for where sports science has developed, and sports science has been applied in the real setting. So the three core sciences which I'm going to just touch on this evening in the talk will be a bit on exercise physiology, a small bit on how biomechanics is applied within rowing, and a little bit on sort of a bit on nutrition, but not maybe the standard view on nutrition. Okay, so physiology. Okay, so looking at this image and working from the bottom up, in exercise physiology, in really simplistic terms, we have three core energy systems in which we use to carry out our tasks. Another one that we are all employing right now will be the aerobic respiration. This system is using oxygen to convert the sugar, which is stored in our muscle as glycogen, and breaking that down to produce the energy that we're using right now. Now, classically, the example you're given when you're learning exercise physiology is that this is what a marathon runner will be using. Because you can, so long as your energy stores, your fuel stores are maintained, you can use this system indefinitely. Here's our marathon runner using aerobic respiration to power their run. Okay, so moving up the diagram, the next one along is the glycogen lactic acid system. So this is essentially the same system as aerobic respiration. It's using the same pathways and using the same fuel, it's glycogen. But the difference is here, when you're working at a slightly higher intensity, you reach a stage where you're unable to take in enough oxygen to be able to metabolise the glucose in the aerobic way. And as a byproduct, you create this thing called lactic acid. Now, you can operate at a fair intensity where that's okay. It's a little uncomfortable, you are producing a bit of lactic acid, but you can turn it over. Once you've gone above that, it starts to accumulate in your muscle, and as you can imagine, the word acid, it's not going to be comfortable. You reach a stage where your blood fills with this lactic acid, and your body says no. You reach fatigue, and you have to stop. And essentially, this is often said to occur, if you're just going flat out using your lactic acid system, you can probably do that for, nearly 2 minutes. And the example they've given here is 400 metre swim, which I was thinking about earlier and I looked at this and I thought that sounds like it should take longer than that. 400 metre swim, I think. I'm not entirely sure how long that should take, but I imagine it would take me a lot longer than...
It's about 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think usually it's a 400 metre run that they would use as the example, but we'll let that one pass. Okay, and then the top system is your phosphagen creatine system. Now this system, I love the example you always use here, it's about 8 to 10 seconds, 100 metre sprint, or probably maybe like a 50-metre sprint for me. It's a little bit ambitious. This is essentially, I don't know if you watch Formula 1, this is like your KERS system that they're employing right now in the Formula 1. Okay, so you've got this this store that you can turn over power very, very quickly, but it's really a very small store. And once you've used it, you have to stop and replenish it. So in rowing, in all sports, it's very unusual that you'll just be using one of these systems at any one time. It's always a sort of a combination of them. And so these fit nicely into training zones. So the top training zone here, the oxygen utilisation training, or LSD, which actually doesn't stand for anything more glamorous than long, slow distance training. This is the training that is usually 1 to 2 hours in duration, and this is really designed to work on that core aerobic capacity, your aerobic system. It's increasing your blood volume, increasing your aerobic enzyme activities, you know, increasing the amount of capillaries going to your muscles, and it's really your base level training. Then you've got the lactic acid, the lactic threshold training. So, you know, usually estimated to be somewhere between 30 to 60 minutes in duration. And this is, so like I said, you know, you're working, if you start exercising above a certain intensity, you increase the intensity a little bit, you'll start to generate some lactic acid. If you start to work at, if you aim to work at that level, then you're testing your body to produce this lactic acid and to clear it again, and you're really testing your threshold there. So by doing that, by training that system, you can increase your body's ability to use the lactic acid as a fuel, rather than it just being an annoying byproduct. Increase your cardiac output, that's the amount of blood that your heart can pump out in a minute. Increase your breathing capacity, and also increase the rate of glycogen. So that's the way that the sugars are stored in your body, in the form of glycogen. Increase the rate of glycogen use. And improve your blood buffering capacity. So buffering is your blood's ability to neutralise this acid. We can do this, and we can train this. And by training at these thresholds, we can get better at that. And the last training zone is the anaerobic threshold training. And again, going back to TV, I think I'm going to be watching far too much TV, but I don't know if you saw the series that Michael Mosey did a few weeks back on TV, where they did talk about this. This is high-intensity training. Somewhere between 30 seconds to 5 minutes in duration. This is brutal. This is training really, really hard, and then resting, and then repeating it. And then resting again, and then repeating again. You know, you do it numerous times. And this is... So, according to the textbooks, this is what it does. It improves your neuromuscular control. It reduces your carbohydrate oxidation and your lactic accumulation, because you're not going to be producing too much lactic at this time. Increase your heat tolerance and your mental toughness, but also... The very recent research has shown that it also increases your VO2 max. But this isn't an area that actually that many endurance sports actually pay too much attention to. So the rowing program, despite the fact that our, as I said in the beginning, our races usually last somewhere between around the sort of 6 to 7 minute mark, the majority of the training is spent in this aerobic training zone, this long, slow distance training. And the idea here is, but really, if you go back to the fact that I gave you right at the beginning, that rowers have high VO2 maxes, a high VO2 max is achieved by this big aerobic base, this long, slow distance training. You know, a big heart, lots of blood, lots of capillaries going to the muscles, and lots of ability to break down the glycogen. And it doesn't change too much. So the blue here is the winter season, and the red is the summer season. Summer is when the racing season is for rowing. And really, I mean, it does change. The ratio between the lactate threshold and the aerobic does change, but not drastically. So, contrary to what you might think, you know, it's an all-out, flat-out race, but the majority of time spent in a 22-hour week is on this long, slow distance training. So one way in which you can monitor people's improvement in their training and their capacity for the sport is through the lactate curve, and this is a very commonly used exercise physiology measure. And again, I've got some data from myself, actually, which I was lucky to have been able to track my own career over the last few years. And the lactate curve is showing, so the point at which I said earlier, there's a point at which you start to generate some lactic acid and you can maintain that level. And it's usually, historically, back in the day, they discovered that most people's is around 2 millimoles, and that's pretty well established it is. It might be just under, it might be just over, but around this 2 millimole mark, you can start to generate it. So this is rest, most people around 1 millimoles of lactic acid in your per litre of blood at rest, and start to push the intensity, so you start to row a bit harder, run a bit faster, cycle up a hill, and you can start to generate a bit of lactic acid, and you can tolerate that. You can tolerate it, and you can clear it, and you can stay there. And that's your lactic threshold. Now, if you look at this purple line here from my data from 2005, and this is when I was a real beginner, and doing a lot of testing when I worked up in the lab at Brooks, really for fun. People do it for fun. I'm not sure that's the right word. And you can actually see, I'm going to show you here, that I actually even started, but this is quite slow on the rowing machine. Anyone who knows rowing, this is a split time. This is very, very slow. This was actually, even back then, too fast for me to start this test, because if you see, my curve just goes straight up. So I have no real capacity at this stage to use lactate as a fuel or to clear it. It's just going straight up. So the same test repeated the following year, and it got a little bit better, but it still it stays lower for longer, so I'm still below this 2 millimole mark for slightly longer, so the curve is shifting a little bit to the right, but still when it goes, it goes. Coming to 2007, that's my first year on the national team, and you see what a change that's made. And the main change to the programme?
What's split time?
Oh, sorry, yeah, my fault there. Split time is just a very popular way in rowing of monitoring your power output. Rather than using watts, we use the time per 500 metres. So it's just a more sort of intuitive way for rowers to compare power output on the row machine to time on the water.
Thank you.
Could you fill in VO2 max with it? Broken. Well, you haven't said what it is.
What VO2 max is? Yeah. Maximum aerobic power. Maximum amount of oxygen in litres that you can use per minute.
And that's not just breathing, is it, Andrew? It's that your body can use.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it sells to
you. It's not lung capacity in any straightforward sense.
No. So the biggest change here in these years was actually in the time spent in that long slow distance training. Training up here was more high intensity, and I didn't have much experience, so I didn't have what they like to coin the aerobic base. And so that's what you can see. That's what the line shifting down and to the right is demonstrating. So in the rowing team, a very popular monitoring session is to do training sessions on the rowing machine, usually at this turn point, this threshold here. And so what will happen is an exercise physiologist will come over to you on the rowing machine and take a lactate sample from your earlobe periodically every sort of 20 minutes of your rowing. And the aim of the game is to try and keep your lactate at 2 millimoles or less for the given output. And so what you can see over time is that your power output is increasing whilst you're staying at that same physiological level. So that's a little snapshot into how physiology monitoring is done in the sport of rowing. So I'm going to swiftly move on now to a little bit on biomechanics. So biomechanics, in my opinion, is actually perhaps still an area which is sort of perhaps underexplored in rowing. I think there's probably a lot more room for using it, particularly in terms of injury prevention. But right now it's used quite well for fine tuning. So we have an idea of what the perfect rowing stroke should look like. Essentially what you're doing with the rowing stroke, it involves quite a lot of sensory motor timing really, because you're up at the catch, this is this point here, up here. The blades, the rowing oars are behind you. The task is to place the oars in the water in time with the boat and also in time with you being in that point there. Okay, so that's a skill in itself that we're not all very good at, so I keep getting told. But that's really important. If you don't get that point right, then if you move back before the oars are in the water, or if you are too long at that point, then you're actually slowing the boat down. It acts as a brake. So that's a really important part of the stroke. The next part of the stroke, the drive, contrary to popular belief, it's not actually an arm sport, this is more a leg sport. So the idea here is that you've now locked the oars in the water behind you, and you're now going to try and push the boat past the oars with your legs, not pull the oars towards you the other way around, so try and push the boat away. And then the finish, that's when the back comes in, and then the oar handles follow, and that's when you propel the boat at its fastest point. So they're sort of key points. This isn't me, by the way, the perfect stroke. I wish. They're the key points in the rowing stroke. And what biomechanics can do with an instrumented rowing gate, which is the rowing gate here, so the oar sits in there and the gate turns as you move, you can put strain gauges on the gate and they can pick up your stroke profile. So what the output can give you is your stroke profile here, and it can actually just help with fine-tuning your rowing stroke. So you can get information about the angle at which your blade's gone in, the shape of your power application, where the power's come off and where the blade's extracted. And all of that can really help to sort of guide you and your coaches in perhaps where you can make subtle changes to your stroke. You can gain a lot of information from video. Video is used quite often, but this really picks up sort of the minutiae of things that's happening under the water. You can see that I should be going around in circles because the dash is left hand and the solid is right hand, so there's definitely some work to be done there. But you can also see, I can see over time from my own personal profile, which is essentially like a little bit like a fingerprint. It's very hard to change the shape of your power curve. It is what it is, often. And so I've often had this historical, like, coming off the... You know, I'll probably be in the Olympic team if I didn't do this, where I've come off the power a little bit too early. Essentially, you want to have as close to a square as possible. But that, over time, has filled out, and that's something that's been really, really useful to see, how the coaching I've received, I've been able to see it paying off, not just in both feet.
Just because of spike.
Sorry?
So the beginner's one just because of spike.
Yeah. Mine used to be, yeah. Yeah, spike. So the other thing it can then do, which is really crucial in rowing, so this is just a person rowing in a single scull by themselves. I mean, it essentially doesn't matter how you do it if you're fast in a single scull. I mean, you're fast, right? Why change it? The problem comes
in
when
you... Does it matter that your two hands seem to have different, quite radically different shapes?
Yes, it does. And what it means is that I have to compensate. So that's perhaps why I usually have injury on my right side and my back, because just to keep a boat straight, you do it on power. So I'm obviously having to compensate for that somewhere. But I mean, it doesn't matter to the boat speed, boat's travelling, but it's probably an interesting point to be followed up in terms of how to perhaps avoid injury. So that's fine, sculling by yourself. The idea is to be as fast as you can, you know, keep the curve as it is. The more interesting thing, perhaps, with the biomechanics is how you form a crew and how you identify what a fast crew is. Well, I don't have the answer for that, and I don't think anyone does yet, to be honest. I mean, sometimes you'll have a fast crew. I didn't show our quads one, actually, which I nearly did because it's terrible. It's like a load of, like, letters. Like, mine's an M, and someone else's like a P. Like, it's just ridiculous. This one is actually quite nice. You can see that my doubles partner is stronger than me, which is a bit embarrassing. But I think I already knew that, so that's okay. And I've still got this crazy discrepancy here. But actually, we're quite well coordinated, and that's this was a double that actually worked quite well. I mean, and I think a bit of information from the biomechanics supports that and supports why the combination was working. So, yeah, biomechanics can be quite helpful. But it hasn't developed a huge amount more than this right now. They're always working on it, but like I feel that it's an area of the sports science which perhaps has not been developed to its full potential yet. Right. Okay, so I'm going to move on briefly to... I said nutrition. I didn't really want to talk too much about nutrition. I thought it would be more interesting to talk about the diet supplementation that we get, the advice on ways to supplement our diet with things that are perfectly legal, but are going to help us go faster. Okay, and the one I liked, which isn't as commonly used, but one I liked, and I have got a sample for any willing volunteer who wishes to try it, is beetroot. Beetroot received a lot of media attention just last year. A group down in Exeter showed that beetroot contains a rather high level of nitric oxide, which is a vasodilator. It makes the vessels get bigger. And actually...
Do you mean airways or blood vessels?
The blood vessels. So it actually aids in the oxygen delivery, which then makes sports performance increase. So I thought, before I try this, because it's horrible, I want to be sure it works. So I did a little test. So I used the same instrumentation here. This is measuring oxygen consumption. It's not actually measuring oxygen consumption. It's measuring the oxygen that you breathe out, the air that you breathe out. We know the oxygen that's in the air, and so by subtracting one from the other, we know what you've consumed. And by doing step tests, exactly the same step test as I described earlier. So the incremental test I did for the lactate testing. It's 4 minutes at a certain work rate, and then you have a lactate test in the other one. This time it's continuous. So after 4 minutes it gets slightly harder, and you keep going until it's fairly hard. And you get a oxygen consumption value for each work rate. And the blue is pre-beetroot, and the green is following 6 days of beetroot loading. So that's concentrated. So beetroot itself, you'd have to eat a lot of beetroot. So beetroot juice is actually the preferred way of consuming the beetroot. And you can see, I think it's really obvious, you know, and perhaps not so much at the top end, but at these lower work rates, the oxygen cost of the effort was significantly, I'm going to use the word significantly because it was, I did the stats, significantly reduced following the beetroot supplementation. So that's a naturally occurring ergogenic aid that's growing in popularity. Not so much yet with the rowing, you do see it, but people are still a bit dubious. I mean, it's, try it, and you're welcome. I'll let you form your own opinion.
You have spare wine glasses,
but yeah, it's just a shot. Okay, so so there are a few other supplementations that are routinely used, and almost everyone you see on the TV this summer will have used, and will still be using these dietary supplements. First one being creatine. I'm always a bit dubious about you, the pots of white powder, but it is everything that we receive in sport has to be batch tested. That means we have to know exactly which laboratory has made it, so that we know that's not been contaminated with anything that might be on the banned substance list. Creatine's been on the sports science scene for years. It's used to help promote muscle gains, and it's often used in resistance training. And so most of the rowing team will be using this in their weight sessions. As a lightweight, I'm less keen on that one because it also causes you to retain water, it makes you heavy. So it's a bit of a balance, but most people will have used that at some stage. The next one, very popular one at the moment, is beta-alanine. This one is it's a non-essential amino acid that is naturally occurring in your diet. I think it's quite high in turkey, but again, to consume it at the most useful level, you do need to have it quite concentrated. So again, it's another pot of white powder, which you take in a loading form. So you take over about 10 weeks, so a small amount every day. And what this does is this acts as a buffer again. So this is reducing the level of acid in your blood, the lactic acid. So this can help you train harder when you're working at that lactic threshold and above levels of that. And then the next one is bicarb. Okay, so bicarb again, a really common one to use. First time I ever saw anyone using bicarb, it was some of the New Zealand team actually. In little capsules of white powder again. What am I doing? What have I got myself into? But it's so widely used across sport. It's another buffer. But this time bicarb is used on race day rather than in a loading phase. It's usually taken about 1 hour before racing. And it essentially works by buffering the acidity of the blood when it's produced within the muscle cells and draws it out and into the blood, so that it essentially delays the onset of fatigue.
So bicarbonate of what? Soda?
Sodium bicarbonate.
Okay. There isn't any difference between that and what you can buy as drinking
ingredient?
No. Yeah, this is one that people need to practice, because this doesn't agree with everybody. So you usually find on training camps a lot of people trying bicarb and making their decision very... I think the decision is made very, very quickly whether it is or isn't going to work for you, because it has some nasty side effects. And the last one is caffeine. Caffeine actually, I think when I first was on the team, was actually on the banned substance list. It's a well-known stimulant, but it's now come off the banned substance list and is something that, is widely used. I mean, we all drink coffee before racing. I've never drunk coffee before racing as a ergogenic aid necessarily. Our races are always in the morning, and we skip breakfast because we're lightweight, so it's just a normal thing to drink. But actually, it's widely used as a supplement, so much so now that we have gels and all sorts to supplement our diet for caffeine. So, in a nutshell then, what will it take to win gold? So it's going to take excellent cardiorespiratory fitness, a high VO2 max, and a high lactate tolerance. supreme skill and sensory motor timing. Got to be able to put the blade in the right place without seeing it, and in coordination with everybody else in the crew. Extreme muscular strength and power. Appropriate fueling, whether that be the right amount of carbs and protein or the particular dietary supplements that you take. Mental toughness. And dare I say it? So yeah, that's all on the formal chat tonight. My last slide is the poster that you have on your table, which is from my research group at Oxford. So if you have any questions about that, then I can answer those in the question time as well.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll take a short break, and Lee and Alice will come around and help fill up glasses and nibbles.